The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Thank you very much for having me. And as I said last time I came, this is a part of a book. The title of the book is called The Human Story. It'll be available from all good bookshops, no doubt, or at least Amazon. It's a work in progress, and so I'm very happy for your interaction. This is to kind of road testing stuff here. And of course, the other thing to say is it's from this, what I'm going to present this morning is more epic in its written form is more epic in length, and so I will necessarily be distilling some ideas, and so you'll be able to help me unpack them. There will be certain contraction to what I say here. Now, the epic is, many people have said, a kind of outdated, outmoded form of literature. We think of epic, we think of ancient literature in particular. So the epic is a sort of primal story. The premise of my book is that as human beings, we live storied existences. We think of ourselves in terms of stories. We think about our lives in terms of happily ever afters, adventures and quests. We think of our lives in terms of tragedies and comedies and what have you. And so as we think in that way, our brains are sort of conditioned to think of our lives in story form. And yet none of these stories quite fit our lives, or we somehow can't narrate our own lives in one of these forms. And so how does the Christian message in particular respond to that? Because I think it does have quite a lot to say about that storied form of human existence. I just dropped my pen. And that's why I'm examining each of these three. And so epic. And as I said, epic is the sort of primal story form. We think of the ancient epics of Greece and Rome and other ancient cultures. But critics have said that since the arrival of the novel, which is an internal form, it's about what goes on inside your head and inside a person rather than, to generalise, rather than action, the epic has disappeared. People have also said that the epic is not a democratic form of literature. It's very much a monarchical autocratic form of literature for a different kind of society. And again, the novel is a much more democratic, bourgeois form of literature. I would say, actually, we actually still are devoted to epic literature, and epic literature is around us in many, many different forms. It's just that the form of the delivery of the epic has changed. So as I'm working away on this book, my son is in the hallway on his computer playing what can only be called an epic computer game. The role-playing computer game has all the complexity and drama of an epic, and even all the artistry of an epic, a great epic. There's great music that goes along with computer games. Believe me, it's absolutely true. You can there are actually orchestras that will play computer game music as a concert because so much artistry has gone into this epic form. What's changed, of course, is that you, as the role player, become the epic hero. It's more than just identifying with an epic hero; you've become the epic hero. The other form of contemporary art form, which has become remarkably suited to epic literature, is of course the cinema. And what the cinema does for us is, because it is so big, and epic is, if nothing else, big, it allows us to visualise epic. And particularly to see the landscape on which an epic narrative may take place. And in particular, the Western and the sci-fi epic are contemporary forms of the epic that we would immediately recognise. Or the fantasy epic. So Lord of the Rings is an epic. Star Wars is an epic. Will it ever end? Please let it end. Stanley Kubrick's movies have been obviously epics. The Alien narratives, the Alien movies, and so on and so forth. So epic is still with us, very, very much so. It's just that we don't read epic poetry in the way that we used to. Mind you, Les Murray, the great Australian poet, not the football commentator, by the way. There are two Les Murrays. Les Murray, the great Australian poet, did write an epic in verse that was published about 15, 20 years ago, and nobody bought it or read it, but I did. So epic is the great story type. It is the great story that tells us about the adventure of the human, the adventure and identity of human beings. And it deals with a particular problem that we as individuals have. It addresses the problem of human mortality. It addresses the problem that human beings are finite and limited. The human individual is small and yet seeks eternity, or seeks an ongoing reputation, seeks to have an impact beyond mortality. The other problem that the other very human problem that the epic addresses is the problem of our agency and free will. The remarkable paradox in human life that we do things, we feel like we do things, and yet we find that sometimes the thing we do is the thing we feel we freely do is something that we could have predicted or that others could have predicted. We find ourselves freely choosing the thing that was destined for us. We have a sense of destiny or fate, and yet we also have this feeling that we are called on to choose various course of action. And of course, this has been a debate within Christianity that has raged. But it's not a debate purely for Christianity, of course. It's a debate for the philosophers, but it's a debate that is dramatised for us in great literature, and especially epic literature, and it's a debate it's a kind of feeling we experience all the time. In fact, neuroscientists are dealing with this very tension at the moment. Do we make a decision? When we make a decision, which we feel is a free decision, can we predict it in our neurology? Can we actually put someone in an MRI machine and see, before they are conscious of decision, what they would make? So are we free or are we determined beings? And what are we to do with that? What's our responsibility then? Are we to blame for anything? Can we be called to a certain set of actions? And so epic literature plunges us into that problem, tries to resolve that problem, and I've got six things that I would say about epic literature. Hopefully you can think of some examples to flesh this out just as I run through. The first thing about epic literature that we see is that epic is what I would call teleological. Teleological meaning it's a story which says that events have a purpose. There is nothing random about events that swirl around in human history. Into the middle of the chaos of the Greeks versus Trojans war in the Iliad, which seems just kind of chaotic and nothing's going to happen there, we discover all along that there is a purpose here. There is a direction, a fate or destiny that's going on all through those actions, all through those events. So the epic says that human history has a purpose. It has an end. It has an end, and it's telling us how we got here. It's showing us how we got. That the events that led up to where we are today are actually completely destined, completely purposeful. And so we can be confident that where we are is, in one sense, the end of history. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. What then the human being has to do is to find his fate and his destiny and be obedient to it. In the Aeneid, Virgil's fantastic poem, which is the best piece of propaganda ever written, which some people no doubt studied in Latin at school, which I didn't because I dropped out of Latin. Anyone do Latin for the... Yes, well done. You did, no doubt did Virgil, yes. I defer to you. Virgil shows us Aeneas kind of torn between his fate and his love for Dido, and yet he is pious. He's pious in the sense that he's dutiful, and so he has this choice to make to follow his destiny, and he does. It's a strange thing to say, isn't it, that you would follow your destiny, since your destiny is what you will turn out to have done anyway. But there you go. So that's the obedience to this telos or destiny or fate is crucial for epic. Secondly, epic is collective. It's about the individual, but the individual as a representative or a talisman of a community. And so epics often attach themselves to national communities, to national identities or tribal identities. The Iliad and the Odyssey, of course, are the great stories of the Greeks. They are the stories of the Greeks and not the story of the Trojans. Aeneas is the great hero of the Romans, and so on and so forth. When John Milton sat down to write Paradise Lost, he was quite explicit, even though that's a biblical epic, he was quite explicit in wanting to narrate a story for his country. It was meant to be an English epic. Edmund Spenser was writing a knightly epic about the English people. How did the English people come to their destiny? How were we founded? And when Les Murray wrote his epic poem, it was a poem about Australia, and it was about Anzac, the myth of Anzac. So it was an epic about Anzac. Interestingly, of course, he was playing on the fact that the Anzac battles took place very close to the scene of the Trojan Wars. And so he was kind of doing a nice segue between those two things. It's an Australian and national epic. It's the quest to found a nation or a people. So thirdly, what's really important in epic literature is bloodshed. There needs to be struggle. There needs to be a real sense of course that makes for good storytelling, of course. But there needs to be a wrestle, and so that destiny is not simply just carried through; it is hard won, and the human being following his or her destiny is doing so at cost and with all the epic virtues: bravery, self-sacrifice, skill, and so on, loyalty. And the importance of struggle and bloodshed is there. Bloodshed is needed as a kind of sacrificial thing in order to establish the foundations of this new civilization. And we find that actually the way we talk about our own national destiny here in Australia, it draws on epic literature. And I've mentioned Anzac before. It's very important to us that we were baptized in blood. And it's still the case, even in liberal democracies, that the myth of the epic myth of war is there as a sort of founding myth of a community. We're founded through the sacrifice of the fallen dead on the field of battle, incredibly crucial for each nation. Interesting to reflect on why that is so. The other thing about epic, I talked about the problem of human mortality. In epic literature, the protagonist recognizes his own mortality. He is a limited human being. He's not a superhero. He is heroic precisely because he's not a superhero, because he may die. Often in the ancient literature, we see the set piece of the journey into the underworld. And there the epic hero goes to the very verge of death itself. But even when he goes on a trip to the underworld to see what death is like, it's there in order to contemplate his own mortality. It serves to underscore that he will be mortal. And so what does the... he's not like the gods, the immortal, the deathless gods, as Homer will call them. He is definitely deathful. Death is his final point. So what's going to happen with that? Well, he will transcend death by the fame of his actions. And this is the great grandiosity of the epic narrator, because the epic narrator is saying, in my epic, you will be commemorated and you will have immortality through my poetry, through my telling of your story. And so immortality comes, but in the form of renown for the epic hero. I've already addressed the fact that epic is a sort of usually a founding narrative for a community of people or a tribe or a nation. And because of that, in epic, history is, as the Russian critic Mikhail Bakhtin once said, an utterly finished thing. Epic takes place, we read an epic looking back, not from the middle of history, but from the end point. So if you're in Augustus's Rome in the 1st or 2nd century AD reading Virgil, you are looking back at the founding myth of Rome. You are now living in what all that history was played out to deliver. History now has reached its end point. That's this kind of settled thing, settled point of view for an epic. It doesn't say, and today we're in the middle of history. It says, today we are living in the Pax Romana because of the bloody struggle that took place because of Aeneas' heroism and because he was able to found a community. So history is an utterly finished thing. The other thing to say about, the last thing to say about epic is that epic is all exterior and very little interior. And so the action all takes place on the outside. It's not about the interior of the human soul. It's not about confession. There are dilemmas, of course, for epic heroes. You will catch them thinking, should I choose this or this? But not for long. Not for long. And usually they go on with the action. We know very little about the inner world of Aeneas or of Odysseus. We're not given that. What we see is their action. We infer their inner states from what they do. But the epic is not interested in that. What happened in terms of literature and the interior is, of course, that comes in with the 18th century and the rise of the novel. There's a connection there, I think, with Christianity, and in particular Puritan Christianity, which got very, very interested in the soul and in diarising the internal state of the human, of the Christian soul before God. And that's something we've become very familiar with, that sort of psychology and the interest we have in psychology. But that's comparatively new. What happens in epic is almost entirely exterior. That might even be the case. What do we know about Luke Skywalker's inner world? Thankfully, not very much. You know, I don't think it'd be very interesting. He's not a very interesting character. He's just kind of... he's exciting. He's not interesting in that way. Okay, so there's six things about epic. I've said obedience to destiny, fate. It's teleological. It's about the destiny of a people, the quest to found a new nation, the importance, therefore, of struggle and bloodshed, the quest for immortality, or the offer of immortality through fame, because of the human mortality, and the mortality of the human being is emphasised, the limitation of the individual who lives on through fame and through the establishment of the community that celebrates this epic. The fact that history is finished. History is something that happened back then. It's now finished. We're living in the post-history era. And lastly, it's not interior so much as exterior. Now, epic has had a massive impact on Christian thought, and Christians have had a massive impact on epic literature. And that goes all the way from Augustine through to John Milton, Edmund Spenser, the great poet of the Elizabethan period, one of the great poets of the Elizabethan period, and Dante, of course, and his Divine Comedy. So that the appeal of these great narratives has been obvious to Christian theologians and authors. Augustine, he wanted to kind of do a counter-narration to Virgil's narration of the city of Rome as transcendent and eternal and holy. Augustine wanted to say, well, actually, we see in the dying years of the Roman Empire, as the barbarian hordes from the north came down and sacked Rome in 410 AD, he wanted to say, well, clearly, Virgil's prophecies about Rome have proved to be quite temporary. This is not the eternal city, it turns out. This is very temporal and very temporary. The city of man, he'd say, was waning, and it's the city of God that is waxing. So he's, in his great work, The City of God, which is not an epic narrative but a theological treatise, he sort of says, look, the prophecies of epic literature have fallen away. What we have instead is the establishment of the kingdom of heaven on earth. Moving forward to Dante, not much to say about Dante, just to note that his epic is strange because it's sort of a journey the journey into the underworld motif is there, of course. He goes heaven, hell, and purgatory, and he kind of in the journey into the underworld, of course, does anyone remember who takes him on the tour of the underworld in the tour of hell? It's Virgil who takes him, Virgil, the author of the Aeneid, who takes him on the tour of hell. So he's quite clearly tipping the lid to hat-tipping the ancient Romans and making a great commentary about the goodness of that literature but its limitation and failure. John Milton, as I said, tried to write a biblical epic, and there's plenty of material in the Bible in one sense to say, yes, that reflects a biblical way of thinking. The trouble, again, it's an underworld setting, Paradise Lost. Lots of it takes place in hell. The trouble was, of course, the best scenes take place in hell, and Milton's Jesus turned out to be a rather flat character compared to his Satan. And Satan became more interesting, which is a bit of a problem if you're going to try and narrate the Bible as an epic and you find that Satan's more attractive than Jesus, I would have thought, just as a kind of a suggestion. Edmund Spencer tried to narrate a Christian narrative in knightly form, so through a kind of Game of Thrones without the naughty bits, sort of a courtly love, courtly romance with knights, and to do that in that way, a sort of warrior myth in the medieval style. So Christians have had that attempt, but I want to go beyond that and just say there are four things that I think a Christian might say, or the Bible might say, as a reflection on and a counter to the epic way of thinking about being a human. I think the epic says something profound about our need for community identity. It says something profound about our mortality and our attempt to transcend it. And it says something profound about our feeling that there is a destiny we might have, but also an agency we have at the same time, a free will, a choice that we have to make. The first thing to say is that when it comes to thinking about teleology, purpose and destiny, Christ is at the heart of a Christian teleology. Jesus Christ is. And one of the things that a Christian way of thinking about history and the world is to emphasizes is that the end of things happens in the middle of things. And so a Christian never says that history has ended and that we're now living in the Pax Christiana. We're not living in a period of peace. We're living in the middle of history, and we can't see the end except for one thing. The only intimation we have of the end is, in fact, what happened to Jesus Christ, who is the man of the future, come into our time, and in particular through his resurrection of the dead, indicating what the purpose of all things is. He's only giving us that information, so we can't tell if Trump is God's man or the devil's man. We can't tell if we can't say that this moment in history is the fulfillment of the times or what history means. Whenever anyone says that I'm on the right side of history, I'm on the wrong side of history, I think we should reach for our guns at that point. Because how do they know? You can't know about sides in history except from seeing from the end. The information we have about history is that Jesus holds the keys to death and Hades. He was dead, but now has risen, and he's the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last. He's the brackets around time. So the one piece of information we have about the telos, the purpose of things, is Jesus Christ. And that means we're in the middle of history, not at its end. We're in the thick of things. We're in the epic, not staring back at the epic, if you like. The second thing to say is that, according to a Christian reading, a human agency, our ability to act, is compromised. It is compromised, but in particularly, it's morally compromised. It's not that we are kind of wrestling with fate and free will so much as we have a call to act freely from God, which is restricted, deeply restricted and compromised by our lapse, by what theologians call the fall. That our ability to do even what we would want to do is corrupted and limited and fallen. But what happens in the Christian message is not then a freeing of human beings from destiny or an addressing of that so much as a renovation of human agency in partnership with the divine agency, in partnership with God. And so it's fascinating in the New Testament how self-control is named as a fruit of the Holy Spirit, so that God both calls us into action and it is his will that we are acting in accordance with, and yet at the same time we are given our self-agency back, we're given our self-control back as a fruit of the Spirit. So much more to talk about there, no doubt, but there is a call to action which we are given a renewed strength to accomplish. Interestingly, the Bible uses epic or quasi-epic imagery at this point, and talks about a spiritual, us being a spiritual battle. And Paul, of course, in Ephesians, asks us to put on the whole armour of God and to equip ourselves like warriors for a battle, but to do so in a very unwarriorly way. The virtues that are given to Christians, that Christians ought to pursue, are not so much the noble virtues of the epic warrior, but they are things like patient endurance, gentleness and humility. Humility would be a completely anathema virtue in the world of the epic. You don't want to be humble, you want to be famous. Fame is how you're going to be immortal, after all. Thirdly, there is, as in the epic, there is in the Christian way of thinking, a creation of a new community, the establishment of a new people. However, crucially, the New Testament, reflecting back on the whole course of biblical history, talks about a global community, an international community, a community not of sameness but of difference, united. And so it is community. It is about an individual, Christ, dying for a community to establish a new community, founding that. But this is not a community established on ties of blood, of blood kinship, but in fact a spiritually united community, a renewed humanity. Internationally, the gathering of the nations, and we see that, of course, in Acts chapter 2 with the Pentecost moment there. And lastly, much more to say, of course, how does a human being transcend mortality in the Christian way of thinking? And again, the resurrection is quite clear, quite crucial here. It's not that human beings transcend humanity by being remembered. We still have that impulse today. People want to be remembered at least by their family, and we set up memorials. We want a legacy. We want to leave some kind of legacy. That's incredibly important for us. And yet, the Christian gospel says that, yes, human beings, you are limited, but that in Christ, there is the possibility not simply of being remembered, but being remembered by God such that you are renewed and resurrected and recreated. There is something entirely solid about the Christian promise of transcending our mortality through what Christ offers, and being part of this created new people, having a renewed and renovated human agency, not simply in the grip of fate, but working in partnership, if you like, with a sovereign Lord, and following the destiny given to us in Jesus Christ. Well, I can already see that there's some just absolutely fantastic questions here, and that your reading has been wide. So first of all, can the epic have a feminine side to it? Example, Xena the warrior princess. Also the alien narratives, the alien movies from the 70s with Sigourney Weaver. And interestingly, in the wrestle with Sigourney Weaver, the alien is what gender? Is also feminine, right? That's the classic line. Take that, you B-I-T-C-H, isn't it? So that's that kind of feminizes the epic for us. Yes, the epic can have a feminine hero, a heroine, of course, because we've seen that, we've got the examples here. But I would say that classically, she does that by taking on classically masculine virtues, by imitating classically masculine virtues. It is the exception that proves the rule in the classic sense, that it shows how butch and masculine the epic is. But we could talk more about that. I don't think that's necessary. I'm not saying that's a good thing, that the classically feminine virtues have their heroic side to them is undoubted. It's just that in the history of humankind, in particular, when you think your nation is a warrior and needs the blood of warriors to set it up, to establish it, then you will emphasize the masculine, and that's why masculine heroes have been so central to epic literature. Is Pilgrim's Progress an epic? I love Pilgrim's Progress, and it does have an epic kind of theme to an epic scope. The epic is big in scope. That's pretty much all you can say about it as a genre. I think it has an epic shape to it. I'll just say that. It is similar. It's got a journey motif, a quest motif. But what you find in Pilgrim's Progress, if you haven't read it, do. It's an amazing book. in Pilgrim's Progress is how weak the Christian is. And I think that's his Christianizing of the epic, is that the central figure is burdened by his sins, and his quest is, in one sense, not to exercise his heroism, but to win his battles by his trust in God. And that's very different. Aeneas doesn't trust in God. Aeneas is pretty heroic, you know. He's helped by the gods, certainly, but he has, you know, you imagine him as having muscles, whereas you don't imagine Christian in the Pilgrim's Progress as being, he comes across as kind of wet. I feel like Christian in the he's more identify with him, whereas Aeneas, I kind of think he works out at the gym. If we can't really predict on which side of history we are, should that influence how we approach controversial topics? Euthanasia, same-sex marriage. I certainly think, and I've written in Eternity magazine just this month, that the language of right side of history, wrong side of history is ridiculous, and it is hubristic. There was an author, Francis Fukuyama, who wrote in 1992, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, he wrote a book called The End of History, which is a silly book to write, but he thought that that meant the triumph of liberal democracy. And what he overlooked was Islam and the rise of the different cultural forces, not just Islam, of course, but he overlooked that North Korea is still bubbling away. And he's a very interesting and sophisticated commentator. He's no doubt reflected on his book, and I've treated him too simplistically. But I think that language of predicting history is deeply troubling. The Bauman Declaration in the 1930s, which was shaped by Karl Barth, Dietrich Bonhoeffer and others in response to Nazism, was a response to just this kind of talk that Hitler was God's man. Quite clearly, history had delivered to Germany Adolf Hitler, and so we as German Christians ought to follow Hitler, even though he's not... Sounds a lot like American Christians' response to Trump, I've got to say. We even though he's flawed and he's not really a Christian, we ought to follow him because God's given him to us in this moment in history. The trouble with that judgment is that history is not finished. The only intimation of the end is Jesus Christ, and that is the only thing for Christians in terms of reading history that we ought to do. We ought to be obedient to Christ because he is the end of history. James Joyce's Ulysses, think about a day as an epic. James, this is quite a long comment here. I just didn't unfold it. So, teleological. They're just the notes. Okay. James Joyce, what about a day as an epic? The thing about Ulysses is it's a sort of it's a takeoff of the epic. It's a kind of subversion of the epic by being so trivial. So it is the kind of narration of this day in the life of a Jewish man in Dublin in 1916. If I got the date right, I think it's June the 16th, 1916 something. If I got the date wrong. 1904, thank you. It's June the 16th, 1904, thank you. And it's that one day, and the very triviality of it, he makes, that's what's kind of funny about it, he makes epic what is just ordinary. Cooking some sausages is epic, or cooking a black pudding is this sort of epic thing. And so that's kind of playing with the genre. And that's a very 20th century thing to do, to sort of subvert it, and make also not a heroic person at the centre, but a quite ordinary and a very flawed person. The other comic epic is The Rape of the Lock by Alexander Pope in the 18th century, where he makes an enormously long poem about the cutting off of the hair of a noble woman. So this goes on for page after page after page, as if it's some significant thing, and he's laughing at the epic form that way. The trouble with epic is, of course, it can be terribly pompous and overblown, and so therefore it makes for comedy. The other epic, the takeoff of the epic is that movie by the Coen brothers. What's it called? Danny Kaye's movies. But I'm thinking of the Coen brothers movie, not No Country for Old Men, but... What's it called? Not Fargo, but there's this movie which particularly used the Odyssey and all the motifs. Starred George Clooney. Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Kind of plays with this, but again, it's sort of with very ignoble figures and in a very funny way plays with these epic themes. I did not refer to Exodus as the Epic of Moses. There's reasons for that. Didn't get to it. But people have said yes, the Exodus is a sort of example of epic. One of the great pieces of literary criticism of the 20th century, though, a book by a man called Eric Auerbach called Mimesis, he compares Homer's work with the Bible's narrative, and he notices how spare the Bible is in its telling of the stories, how very blank it is, and how detailed, on the other hand, the epics are. The epics kind of give you more detail than you need, and digressions all over the place, whereas the Bible gives this very simple, direct way of encountering the subject matter. But you could say that the epic certainly has the Exodus certainly has an epic feel to it. It's big in scope. It involves the shedding of blood. It involves the sacrifice of the firstborn. It involves the dramatic escape of a people and the founding of a people. But you notice too the ironies at work, that really God is the hero. God goes before them. It's not Moses who's the epic hero. In fact, he's a deeply flawed individual, and the people that he saves, their flaws are on display all the way through. It's not kind of any. I think this is true of the Bible as this strange book in the Old Testament that the Romans would never have let people know about themselves what the Jews let people know about themselves in their own work. It's this remarkable book of the flaws and failings of the people of Israel, as well as its better moments. Michael, can you tell us the name of your son's epic role-playing computer game? There are numerous. I couldn't name one, but Skyrim is one that he has played, and many, many others. I don't take much notice, I'm sorry to say. Could it be suggested that the Apostle Paul introduced the biography by describing his inner life, e.g. Philippians 3? Yes, and I'm going to say this in my book. Paul tells us really about he's an introspective person. In fact, he'd be one of the most ancient introspectors that we know. This gets maximized in Augustine, and there's a kind of crucial academic essay from the 20th century which talks about the title is Paul and the Introspective Conscience of the West, and it says that the claim is that Paul wasn't really introspective. I think Paul is massively introspective. But that Augustine bequeathed to the Western Christianity especially this idea that we are to give account of our souls to God. And even as converted Christians, we examine ourselves, which again is not something that epic heroes do. There's no sort of self-examination. That's not done. You just go and act. You do what you do. What would I say to those who say Christian belief is merely an appeal to certainty, in the light of my comment that we are in the epic? An appeal to certainty. Well, I would say this. I would say that the appeals to these different stories that we do, we want our lives to be comics or epics, often find them to be tragic. We find we can't narrate our lives in the way we would like, even though we think of our lives as unfolding in these patterns, in these narrative patterns. The Christian alternative doesn't say that here's a narrative that's all set out. It leaves plenty of room for uncertainty. It gives you one single point of certainty. I think that's the resurrection. Oliver O'Donovan, the great English scholar in particular, names that. He says, and what I've said about history is true of individual lives as well, we cannot predict what comes ahead of us, and we're not given in the Christian gospel what comes ahead of us in our lives. We're not given control of those things. The great heresy of the prosperity doctrine says that if you become a Christian, you'll become wealthy. And that's the antithesis of Christianity. It says you don't know what's going to happen. It actually says you can be You can actually go into a sort of agnosticism about what's ahead. What we don't get from Christianity is the view from everywhere. We don't get this view from... We don't get the God's eye view. What we get instead is the knowledge that there is a God's eye view. That's the thing to cling to. So I would say it's a still point in the midst of a maelstrom, the eye of the storm, rather than a kind of an aggrandized view of what humans can and can know. And so it gives grounds for plenty of uncertainty, plenty of appropriate human uncertainty. I hope I've understood the question correctly. I've read a number of authors, books and media lately talking about how the Western world, inverted commas, has lost its narrative, lost its purpose, morality. It's in flux. We don't know where we're going. Do you think this is because as a culture we're rejecting the Christian epic that built the Western world? I think so. I think the Christian frame, the Christian story, gave us a way of sitting loose and being, as I say, self-critical of our foundation myths. That's one of the great gifts that it gives to us. In fact, I was listening to comedian David Mitchell talking about how great it is to be English, and he said one of the great things about English is that we can being English is that we can criticise being English. You know, we're not. We understand that to be English is to be flawed, and that England is a flawed Britain is a flawed idea. I think that's actually a very Christian thing to think, and it gives a sort of humility to nations that nations themselves and people who are members of nations that nations themselves need. With that lost, then I think we lose our sense of service of one another, and we instead become tribalistic. The Christian vision, of course, is international, and the more we retreat from that vision, the more we cling to nationalism. And I find Peter Fitzsimmons' work fascinating for this. He's an atheist, of course, but there's no such thing as an atheist. His God, his religion, is Australia. So he wants to set up a national... And interesting how he keeps telling us the stories of what... He keeps publishing books on the war. He's going to run out of First World War commemorations very soon, but he's doing that because where else do you tell a story of a people except through the war myths and sport as well, as a sort of exemplar of these epic virtues. He's certainly an epic poet for our times, such as it is. Two questions just to finish. How similar or different are Aeneas and Jesus? We both have to find their telos purpose, duty, and then follow it. Not my will, Lord, but yours. I think they are similar in that. I would say that. Jesus never goes off and has an affair with an African queen in a cave, however. There are similarities there, but interestingly that Jesus dies, Aeneas lives. That's kind of crucial. Lastly, I did not refer to Exodus. Yeah, no, I've done it already. Thank you.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.